Dear Mom, I know you've tried to protect me from who I am, and you've said my life before you adopted me doesn't matter, but it does matter. It matters because I still have visions of the place where I was born. I've heard all the whispers. I know what happened in that town where I was born. And I know you've tried to protect me from its horror for 19 years. Well, today I'm going back to that little abandoned town called Gatlin. Home to the truth. Love, Hannah.
Welcome to Percolated Media's Children of the Corn series, part of the 3-Minute Retrospectives look at the film adaptations of author Stephen King.
Give yourself. It's his will.
Join Garrett.
Don't underestimate the power of my vision.
Matt.
He speaks to me always, but today he is displeased.
And Adam.
Is this how they come to a complete stop in California?
As they find out who of the three of them really agrees with he who walks behind the rose.
He who walks behind the rose will decide your fate.
Will the three podcasters survive this trek through rows and rows of corn?
I got your eternal flame right here!
Find out next, courtesy of Percolated Media.
Come on, let's go!
He Who Walks Behind the Rose, we podcast for you. Continuing with Children of the Corn 4, The Gathering. This was released October 8th, 1996, and it was directed by Greg Spence. You know, Matt, at the end of the last podcast, you were talking about how I don't recognize the name Greg Spence. Well, I did a search on him. He has quite the resume. He produced a show called Game of Thrones, and right now he's producing a show called The Last of Us. But his directorial credits were this and The Prophecy 2. But he is a big name in the HBO realm. He's worked on a lot of HBO shows.
Good for him. Everybody's got to eat.
All right. So last week we had some fun with Children of the Corn 3. This week we have an Oscar-nominated actress by the name of Naomi Watts. Adam, what'd you think when you saw, oh, God, Naomi Watts is in one of these as well?
You know what? It's amazing how many horror franchises kind of give young actresses specifically their start. So, okay, I'm a fan of Naomi Watts. I think she's done some amazing work. I didn't think this was going to be something I can say that about, but it was nice to at least see a name that I recognize. Though, I'll say it here, I don't see Naomi Watts when I watch Naomi Watts in this film. Look, when I watch Leprechaun, I can see Jennifer Aniston. I don't see Naomi Watts here. But hey, you know what? I'll say I'm going to give at least a 1 for Ms. Watts.
And there's also another name by the name of Mark Salling who's in this. He was also in Glee later on, and he ended up doing some things that aren't worth re-mentioning. If you're that curious, go back and Google him. But this was his debut as well. He played the older kid in this. Matt, did you at least have a little bit of hope when you saw that Naomi Watts was in this?
I would call it a glimmer. It's like when you see the sunrise over a field of corn, where you just have to hope it's there, but you don't know if the sun's actually going to come out fully. That's my mentality going into every single one of these movies now. Just give me a glimmer of sunlight and don't just rain on me for 90 minutes.
Yeah, well, she has said that she was paid $5,000 for her work in this film. That was it. Dimension shelled out $5,000 for her to be the lead in this particular film. And you know what? I'm going to go ahead and say, I mean, she does some things in this that she would do later on in her career as well. There's some similarities between this role and her role in The Ring later on. We open up with not a 4 subtitle, just Children of the Corn, The Gathering title. So they're not even doing numbers at this point. Matt, there was some point when we talked about the Friday the 13th films. At one point, they were like, you know what? We're embarrassed by how many are being done. Here, they've gotten rid of the number by the number 4.
Well, Friday, they stuck with it up until 9. Only yeah. Because they called it the final Friday. Bullshit, but...
Yeah.
This is where Amazon started to fuck with me, because I have to write in the specific subtitles for these movies. I can't just type in the number 4, because they all come up, and I don't know which one is which.
So we see a boy show up at a woman's house asking for help as he shows a scar on his wrist. She brings him inside as we're hearing big sounds on the Foley work, and she says that he's hot to the touch. And this is Karen Black. A lot of people know her from the Rob Zombie films that she would do later on, but she had quite a career, didn't she, Matt?
Oh, she also gave me a glimmer of hope because I half expected her to be chased around by a Zulu warrior doll through most of this movie. That's the main thing I know her from is Trilogy of Terror.
Yeah, that was at least, I mean, she was the first one I recognized. I was like, hey, wait, that's a face and an actress that I was like, okay, somebody can at least act that they hired for this film.
I believe she was an Easy Rider too, wasn't she? Or one of those.
I think so.
Yeah. She drops a glass, which moves around the drain, and we're hearing sermons on the radio. The boy refuses to lay back as he sweats, and she starts putting alcohol on the wound. He stands up and then rises on the floor before rising up as a zombie, and then she wakes up. And that's how we start. You know what? I'll go ahead and say, I like this beginning. I think it starts off well.
Yeah. All right. One of my least favorite tropes in horror movies. I fucking hate hallucinatory dream sequences. I hate them. I hate them. I hate them. And this movie will double down where we have nightmarish dream sequences within nightmarish dream sequences.
Yes.
This one works because it's the prologue and it gets the ball rolling as far as being the harbinger of what's to come. But God, did they overplay that card throughout this entire movie.
This was an Elm Street movie through and through, man.
And God, so much so, the main villain, they gave him Freddy Krueger's backstory. Josiah is Freddy Krueger.
You know, this kid shows up. I'm like, hey, we're a little different. I get that Dimension logo, and I'm a little sad because I realize that I'm not watching one of the Hellraiser films. And I see Stigmata on this kid. I'm like, ooh, maybe we're going a different direction. And we get this opening. I'm like, hey, we're doing something a little. Oh, my God, it's a fucking dream. I am pissed, and I want to throw my remote across the room.
And already? Yeah, dude, we're not 5 minutes in.
It's a fucking dream. Oh, my God. It's just, and yeah, to Matt's point, call Leonardo DiCaprio, because you're going to inception me later on with the amount of different dream levels this thing goes into. Oh,
right. There are a lot of dream sequences in this.
Yeah, there's so many, I half expected docking music to start playing.
It does at some point feel like it could have been a spec script for a Nightmare sequel.
We cut to Naomi Watts driving along and through Grand Island, Nebraska. And let's not forget, boys, this is also 1996. This is probably right before Scream had hit, so we're still going through these horror tropes. We're hearing about how a small-town America has taken a few steps back the last decade as she pulls up to a house and says, "Welcome home." She walks up as her mom answers the door, and we cut to some corn activity going on in the backyard. So, yes, we have to have corn here. There it is. She says hi to Doc, and she says that she was given the okay to be away for one semester. So she was given the okay to be away for one semester from college, huh? Okay. We then see Margaret as a fairy princess, and she looks outside at James working on a bike. And did we have any freaking surprise when we find out that this girl is her daughter? What a plot twist.
Well, the age gap alone between Karen Black and this little girl, I'm like, okay, this is clearly not on the up and up. I may be stupid for agreeing to watch all these movies, but don't insult my intelligence, movie.
Her mom says that James never listens to her anymore. We flash to a dead corpse as a transition. And the doctor tells Grace that her mom is doing better than before, but she won't take a step past a certain walkway.
It's literally Beetlejuice, where she can't step outside the house.
Exactly, yeah, we just covered that.
Isn't there a pet cemetery right on the other side of that road?
Well, there are no dogs here. The secret is to relax her and convince her the world is in a bad place. Grace asks if she can have her old job, and the doctor says, sure, why not? So
there's only six adults in this town, so...
She was a nurse, but she's in school, but she got a semester off, but she comes back to be a nurse, and at one point the doctor calls her doctor. What the fuck is going on?
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot wrong with this. I mean, I look at this and I'm like, okay, I've taken semesters off college as well. That's why it took me so long to graduate. You know, like, I get it. Because she wants to take care of her mom. Her mom had another episode. So I like that part of the story. I do like that entry point. But yeah, there's small things like this. I'm like, what the fuck are you doing? So she is a doctor, but she isn't a doctor, but she's off for one semester, or is she going to be here for longer? We just don't know. So we see a guy enter a farmhouse and grab some water, which is located right next to a corpse. He drops the bucket as bugs are crawling around inside. He drops his liquor bottle and goes to great lengths to reach it, but this doesn't do him any good as he's stabbed in the leg and then the arm and eventually killed, for he should not be taking strong drink.
Stephen King has an alcoholism analogy in the book. No way.
I can't believe I'm watching another movie starring Naomi Watts where the plot gets rolling because a child crawls out of a well.
Yep. That's the similarity I was thinking of.
That's right.
So James tells Grace about Charles Manson and how good a guitar player he was, and then tells Margaret that she's staying as long as it takes for her mom to get better. And Margaret says that she's not afraid of anything. She then tells Grace that she likes her better than mom, or who she thinks is her mom. We see June still struggle as Grace tells her to continue taking the pills as the doctor prescribed. Grace then finds a cross and says that they're not Catholic.
Because only Catholics use a cross, not every single aspect of Christianity.
Right. We see a kid discover the body of the guy killed earlier as we cut to Margaret sleeping as he makes the blood a symbol on his hand. Grace starts cleaning up the place as Margaret walks in and says that she's hot. Grace says that she has a fever and tells her to tell if she needs anything. And we're also hearing that James has the fever as well. So we have discovered a different way to get He Who Walks Behind the Rose inside these people, boys, or at least the influence inside. They're sick. So this fever makes them follow?
Yeah, I like how they treat religion as literally like a virus that infects people. This was a good way to, good in quotes, a different way to go about the same goddamn premise. To treat it like an epidemic. Like, this might as well be like Outbreak from the year before. I mean, it's about as silly as that movie is, so it matches.
You know what? Anybody who has kids know you get them in school one day, all it takes is one kid to get sick and they're all sick. But if your child, if their temperature goes up like 7-8 degrees in the span of about 30 minutes, your child's about to die. They have a fever, but man, what they do with it is, it's a choice, but it's a plot point to get to the next one.
Grace then heads down the road with her friend Marianne, who says that they were never the fucking Brady Bunch, and she says that she's now a nurse. Grace asks how they grew up so fast, and Marianne says maybe she should think about staying home. We cut to June walking outside and dropping papers as she's being looked at. Grace is struggling at the clinic as more kids come in with the fever. The doctor says he's going to keep the more serious cases of this virus overnight as we see June taking more pills. But of course, we have another nightmare of a kid committing murder. We see all the kids start having nightmares as an Amish-looking kid in a hat looks on, a.k.a. Freddy, right, Matt?
Uh-huh.
Fevers are raised. Grace preps an ice bath as kids are let in against their will, and then they become possessed before the fevers start going down. Grace sees the boy in the hat who says that she was calling for her, but she's come in now before walking out. This ends up being another dream, though, as Grace wakes up and the doc says that he's leaving, so you need to keep an eye on things.
Good doctor.
Yeah, right. The kids are all given a clean bill of health as we cut back to June, who's still struggling. We then cut to a bug on the wall. Marcus then opens his window and reveals kids outside as his mom is sliced up. This was a crazy scene.
This feels like it was right out of Salem's Lot.
Oh, yeah.
Suddenly you're just pulling it back and it's just like, same quality of makeup from way back that original one as well.
But here's the thing. You have this Children of the Corn franchise. You've got to differ it up a little bit. I think they're doing a decent enough job of differentiating this.
Yeah, this is definitely a break from formula that we've seen. I mean, the last one changed it up by going to the hood for all intents and purposes. This one's changing it up by treating it like a disease movie. The biggest disease is that this thing keeps mutating when we have seven more of these goddamn things.
Grace notices Margaret a little cut up as she tucks her in. We cut to the crime scene as Donald says something attacked him, and now something is wrong with his son. Marcus climbs the fence as the sheriff goes after him, and then we see the boy disappear in the cornfield as the sheriff pursues. He hears whispers, and Marcus throws him his mom's head before he's impaled. Boy, just another just crazy, crazy scene here.
Yeah, this one's got a lot more of a mean streak than the previous two did.
Definitely.
It does, and you got some random, I don't want to say random, but you got some inventive thing. Shit, that may not even be the right word. You got kills thrown in where it ups the gore. For the fourth in a series, you got some scenes where suddenly you are definitely getting some blood splatter.
And it just made me wonder, like, are these kids zombies? And another thing about this movie, too, we never hear the phrase, he who walks behind the rose. We never hear it.
Is it the blood that this kid is, because he sets, like, you draw something on his hand, it sets flame, you know, Hadouken, how is he controlling what's going on? nothing is explained. They just happen.
Yeah, this movie is not preoccupied with a whole lot of explaining until the last, where it's just a fucking info dump.
Yes.
That's putting it mildly. Donald sees the crime scene and then leaves. Meanwhile, Grace has a nightmare about Margaret being covered in sores and saying, "Help me," as well as stabbing her. This was your dream upon a dream, right, Matt?
I was getting increasingly irritated with these as the movie kept pulling this out of its ass. Like this is one of my least favorite tropes in any kind of film.
Which is the nightmares and whatnot. Yeah,
because it's padding out a movie that's already padded. It's 85 minutes.
Donald visits a Mrs. Nock to ask her if he can hide in her place for a while. Meanwhile, Grace tries to help Margaret get rid of some rashes, but she has an allergic reaction to the rubbing alcohol. This poor kid, man. She's just...
When she had a reaction to it, I assumed there was some type of holy water that was about to come into play. Because mm-hmm. It's such a weird inclusion that is happening here on her skin. And it just, yeah, nothing makes sense.
She drives her along as a news report plays in the background, and the doctor sees two kids who are now calling themselves Zeke and Caleb. The doctor tells the kids that he's been here his whole life, and a long time ago he saw two boys who had a lot wrong with them, and that he's going to suggest to their mother that they need to be punished. June tells Grace that she feels even though she's taking the pill, she feels like she's getting worse. And every time she closes her eyes, the boy is there. We see the boy appear to the doctor as the boys stalk and kill him, slicing him in half with a blade on a stretcher. This is an interesting tool, this little...
Yeah, of course, a movie called Children of the Corn involves the word stalking.
But we're also not getting the big Sith that they have on these in these films.
It's on the goddamn poster, but it's not the goddamn movie.
I know, it's crazy. And you know what? I'll give it this. You know, Naomi Watts, I think she's giving it her all here in this small part. I don't mind her in this. I actually think she's not bad in this movie. I'll say that.
I would like to give her my all as well, which is not much. God damn it. She's fine. I mean, she's in a direct-to-video fourth installment of a horror franchise. So I'm glad she was able to have a career after this. You know, but she's not bad. But she's just really not in a good movie.
On the curve of adding any semblance of credibility to a Children of the Corn Part 4, I think she is above par.
We cut to Grace at the clinic as Donald appears and needs answers. He tells her that the virus that was inside Marcus did something to him. She says that the tests done on her sister indicate that she has the virus too. He then says he just wants to get out of this godforsaken town. Grace is taking the kids to school, and we're getting slow motion shots of a bouncing basketball. What is it about basketball in these films?
Well, because they probably tried to have somebody skip rope, but they got sued by New Line Cinema.
She asks Margaret what's wrong as a tooth dislodges from her mouth, as she's not Margaret. And what is it about teeth? I think there's some religious semblance of falling teeth or something. I can't remember it. We see a kid with a busted arm come up to June's place, and this is playing out much like the beginning of the film, as the glass breaks and moves, and June goes into the other room where she sees the boy from earlier. She runs outside only to be stalked, drives off in her car. As Grace pulls up to the clinic, there's nothing but chaos. The doctor is nowhere to be seen, so Grace is in charge of everything, and we're seeing teeth that have been collected as June stops the car. She gets out when she spots James, and as she walks into where she thinks she saw him, June is attacked, and once again the camera cuts before an actual impaling takes place.
You know what else is missing, though, is all the blood that we did see when Doc got killed.
Yeah.
Like she goes into the building, and there's no remnants of this murder that happened. So I'll say this attack on the car, I'm going to give it a compliment. It felt like that original short film that we watched way back at the beginning of these.
Matt, did you like this at all, or are you just trying to get through it?
I thought this was fine. Like, I don't turn on this movie for a while. I just don't think it's all that particularly well shot. Which I know it's a Children of the Corn direct-to-video movie, but this one's got a really ugly color palette, and I do think this one of the four is the slowest as far as pacing goes.
You know, it's interesting you say that. This movie is 85 minutes. This was the longest 85 minutes I've had to watch for this podcast. It felt like it took forever. And, you know, and last week I had such a good time with that movie. I'm not saying it was good, but I had a good time with it. And here you're right. This one's uglier. This one's meaner. And it's slower paced. And I don't mind that if I'm really digging the story, but this story just is not going anywhere. And I'm getting impatient at this point. Back at the clinic, Marianne is freaking out that Rob isn't there. And Grace says that the blood samples aren't chemically right. Donald tells Grace to leave the child as they have someplace to go. He takes her to Mrs. Nock, who tells Grace all about the kids and the old-time religion associated with them, which of course involves one boy not aging, more than likely due to he who walks behind the rose. Matt, this is a trope that you and I have discussed a number of times, this character who knows it all.
Yep, the people that live in this town that secretly hold all the answers.
It's amazing. I think I'd almost seen this in a film before. You know, I mean, I'm surprised they didn't get Heather Langenkamp to play this role. It is, God dang, this is fucking stolen so much. Mm-hmm. But I'm also surprised because when I read the synopsis, because yes, I read the synopsis, I thought this was the same town and maybe it is or maybe it's not. I literally can't tell an hour into this thing. But if so, I don't know why these people are here or anything else. And it just, I don't know, it's taken a weird turn. I don't hate this reveal, other than it's just completely stolen from Nightmare on Elm Street. And many other tropes, but that's what I get from what we get told here.
Oh yeah, especially given all the dreams, you can't fucking not think of Nightmare on Elm Street while watching this.
No, and at this point, Dimension Home Video was trying to be like New Line Home Video, so it's there, but man, it's blatant.
We cut to Marianne in the clinic as she drops the blood samples and the blood just won't stay still. Knox says that they dragged the boy to the field and burned him up, and they took his bones and ashes deep inside a well and sealed them up. Yet he has found a child like himself and plans on having the child take his place so Josiah can possess them all.
7 days.
Yeah. You are all my children now.
Yeah. Of course, it's up to Grace and Donald to stop this. We see Marcus cut his hand to offer his blood to Josiah, despite the risk of bleeding to death due to him being a hemophiliac. Meanwhile, Grace tells Donald that the like child is Margaret, so Grace sets out to write what she did, which was lie to her. Because, of course, this is when it's revealed, she's her mom. Dun, dun, dun.
What? No way. You mean the 60-year-old woman didn't have a 10-year-old daughter?
Apparently not.
But she still had the 13-year-old boy.
I know, right?
Yeah, that's true. They were pregnant at the same time.
Right. We cut back to the clinic as the blood vials grow and Marianne sets out to find Margaret, yet she's just impaled by syringes and taken out by a scythe from behind. Again, just brutal deaths here, right, Adam?
They are, and they're hokey. Like, if this entire thing was more fun, I would be enjoying, because some of these kills are like 5, 6, 7 in the Hellraiser series, you know, and sometimes you can enjoy it. But the rest of this movie is just, there's no fun. And to Matt's point, it's an ugly film, so you can't even enjoy when these things show up.
Speaking of showing up, Grace shows up at the clinic only to find Marianne's body and the samples of mercury, which is quicksilver, meaning they need to get to the supply closet.
So he's a werewolf, basically.
Yeah.
I didn't realize until I was thinking about this film later, God, I can't believe I just said that sentence, that's why the kids were rejecting the thermometers at the beginning of the film.
We cut to the children bathing in blood and giving up their own flesh. As Grace and Donald, they head towards the spelling farm. We see Donald lay some shells with mercury as Grace takes a shortcut. The ceremony of flesh continues as Margaret offers Josiah her soul. And after she's pulled in the pool of blood, Josiah emerges.
We have gone from Nightmare on Elm Street to Cult of Jason, the Miners version.
So much wow. So that there's the black guy who's the bounty hunter from part 9.
Yep. Grace and Donald show up, and Donald says which shells are mercury and which ones are just regular shells as he just gives her the shotgun. We go inside the farmhouse as Donald is attacked in his truck. Grace shoots a boy who pushed her down off a deck as she hears voices and sees Doc. She loads the gun with the black shells as she moves deeper inside and is once again attacked by Josiah. She shoots a water spout full of mercury, and after Grace slices him with his own scythe, Josiah melts like the Wicked Witch of the West as the flesh is melting off like the guy from Poltergeist.
So do you know who plays Josiah? I found this.
I don't.
Nope.
So you remember that Indiana Jones fan film? It was called like Indie Fans and the Quest for Fortune and Glory.
Yes.
He's the director.
Is he really?
Yes.
That's so funny. Wow. That's crazy. Grace then pulls Margaret out of some water as she performs CPR and rescues her. We see the group visit June's grave as James leaves his terror trading cards, saying he doesn't think they're funny anymore. So it took this for him to go through in order for him to think, you know what, serial killers aren't funny anymore.
Also, what kid is obsessed with Charles Manson?
I know, right? As they get to their vehicles, they say goodbye to Marcus and Donald. Margaret calls Grace mom, as Grace actually abandoned her as a teenager, and James takes out a bug on the rearview mirror, which was the weirdest scene. This movie needed to end, but we have to elongate it as James is looking at this bug on this mirror. Like, what exactly is he going to do? Is he going to eat it? Is he what exactly is he going to do? Of course he's going to fucking smash it. And then they just elongate this to elongate the minutes left in this film.
Yeah, it's like they had to wait to get some additional celluloid to make this movie feature length.
Exactly.
It's a grasshopper. I don't know why you couldn't have just had, like, an ear of corn on the hood and he throws it off. Like, I'm going to say that. But, like, there's no doubt what he's going to do. I guess it was supposed to be suspenseful if he's still in the cult of King Josiah or not. But,
All right. Well, enough thinking. Let's get to their scores. On a scale of 1 to 10, what do we give Children of the Corn, The Gathering? Adam?
For a Children of the Corn film, it's amazing how little amount of corn is in this film. Other than being set around some cornfields, it really doesn't play into this. And yeah, I can't believe I'm going to say it. I need some corn back. This thing's pretty goddamn bad. It feels like it steals from so many early 90s films and does it pretty poorly. Other than Naomi Watts, you know, there's not much in this film that's passable. The woman that plays her mother, she does a good job. But everything in here is forgettable. It's stupid. The kills, while they could be fun and inventive, they're just surrounded by so much emptiness that all I want to do is rush through this film. And for only an hour, what is it, hour 28? God dang, this thing feels twice as long. It's a shame because I do think the idea of He Who Walks Behind the Rose and this being changed into something different is an idea, but it just does a piss poor job. Take me out and bury me in those cornrows too. Hey, you know what? Naomi Watts walking through a barn with a shotgun looks pretty cool. I'm surprised she actually didn't do some action movies in the late 90s because, you know what? She actually holds up her end of the bargain there by the end. But this thing it's piss poor. It's a ripoff of some of the worst Jason films. It's a ripoff of the story of how Freddy Krueger came to be. There's no reason to watch this other than if you are forced to as a completionist. Thanks, Garrett. I love you, buddy. But in the way of this being the fourth corn film, I can't even give it a 4. I am going to give it a 3 because I still think we're going to go down from here. But 3 on 10 for Children of the Corn, The Gathering, because there is no Children of the Corn 4.
You already gave it a 1 due to Naomi Watts' presence, so that's actually a 2 from you.
But officially a 3.
Officially a 3 on 10 from Adam. Matt, can you go higher?
No, I can't bring myself to elevate this movie anymore. I think of the 4, this was the one that was the biggest chore to get through. And I say that as someone who did not like the first one. Because I can deal with banal, but when you start, don't invoke better movies by just ripping them off part and parcel like this movie does. I think that's a cardinal sin that I will hold against any and all movies if you can't do it better. And I just found this a laborious thing to get through. So I'm basically in lockstep with Adam. This is a 3, and I think I'm being generous.
Yeah, I have the same exact score written down as you guys, believe it or not. The thing that damns this film, there are so many of these films that, Matt, you and I watch. We like schlock. We like bad horror. Horror that's so bad it's good. This movie's biggest sin is that it is boring as fuck. And at 85 minutes, you can't make a movie move. There's something wrong. And it's not helped by the fact that we have so many goddamn dream sequences that the movie is trying so hard to tell us what's going on in these people's heads without actually telling us. Even given all that, yes, I am dissecting a fucking Children of the Corn movie, but the kills, you can at least make the kills good. Last week's film was not a great film, but we had a lot of fun with it because of the kills in it, amongst other things. Here, there's nothing you can really grasp onto to say that it's fun. Naomi Watts looks like she's collecting a paycheck in the early stages of her career. And we have Karen Black, who I usually like. I do. One day we'll get to the Rob Zombie films. I think she's fun in the right role. But this role, again, is her just pretty much collecting a paycheck. So this can't even get as high as a 4 with me either. This is a 3. A pretty ponderous watch, and that's saying something given that it's not even 90 fucking minutes. All right, so we have 4 down. We have 7 more to go. Next week, I have some hope. I gotta say, next week, I look at the cast list. We have some fun to be had. Matt, last time the three of us discussed Alyssa Stark Head, it was on something, Sometimes They Come Back. Again, one of those Sometimes They Come Back sequels. I thought he was fun in that. We also have the presence of David Carradine somehow.
What?
Yes. And another actress who would go on to do great things, an actress by the name of Eva Mendes, makes an appearance in next week's film. And Kane Hodder. We have a lot of interesting names in next week's movie. Matt, what are you expecting when we discuss Children of the Corn 5, Fields of Terror?
Well, you lost me at Children of the Corn 5, and that cast list boasts as much confidence in me as the Jets' starting lineup, so... no optimism on my end. I think from here on out, I'm in full tank mode.
Wow. You're not expecting anything, huh? That's quite the cast list. You liked Alexis Arquette in Sometimes They Come Back.
Yeah, but they're not a major... I never went to go see a movie because of them.
All right, well, Adam, what are you expecting? We have Eva Mendes next week. That should brighten your senses, huh?
You know what? 1998, Eva Mendes? Yeah, maybe not. Or maybe. Let me see. David Carradine, Kane Hodder, Alexis Arquette, Fred Williamson. Are we doing it from Dusk Till Dawn? I got no faith in this. I hope they could find a way just to be schlocky fun. You know, we watched Urban Harvest and we all at least could revel in its silliness. And I hope we get back to that. Give me some blood. Give me some horror. Give me some splatter. But I was surprised how chaste this film was. You know, if you're going direct to video and you're rated R, I'm sorry. Give me some nudity. Give me some blood. Give me some language. Or don't bother. So I'm hoping I get some of that next week. Man, I think every one of these films is going to be a struggle.
All right. Well, that's next time we discuss Children of the Corn. We are going through these, like I mentioned. We are posting these 2 a week. We're going to get through them as quick as we can. We have some other things coming up to close the year. But first, we got to get through this corn. But until next week, when we discuss Children of the Corn 5, Fields of Terror, what hath the podcast commandeth? Thank you, boys.
We must sacrifice them both tonight.
Amos will satisfy him. We need the woman. She'll bring the man to us.
No. He must be taken without her. We cannot remove her from this place. It is holy.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast, exclusively here on Percolated Media.
Why don't you put that in your god and smoke it?
Come back every Friday as new retrospective reviews are posted weekly on your favorite podcast platform of choice.
Question not my judgment, Malachi. I am the giver of his word.
And keep coming back as the boys will continue going through the works of Stephen King in publication order.
Want you too, Malachi.
And if you would be so kind, please take a moment and give us a positive review and rating on your podcast platform of choice. It truly helps others find and discover our podcasts.
You guys all belong in an asylum somewhere, loony bin. Where are your parents?
And if you like this review, please head over to percolatedmedia.net or search your podcast streamer of choice. For we have individual reviews such as Knock at the Cabin, The Black Phone, Megan, as well as additional blockbuster franchises like the Mad Max movies, Avatar, the Planet of the Apes franchise, Pirates of the Caribbean, Indiana Jones, movies featuring the team-up of Leonardo DiCaprio and Martin Scorsese, Jurassic Park, and so many more.
You are a sinner. You are the fire of the corn. It will do you no good to curse me.
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is produced by Garrett, Matt, Adam, and Nathan.
You know not the laws. He speaks them only to me.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is voice narrated by Adam.
Assuming that it's ever stopped.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is edited by Garrett.
You know, if you're gonna keep visiting Isaac, it's probably something you should know. It's a small town. People are gonna talk.
This podcast is not affiliated with any film studio or network, and all opinions expressed on the Three Men and a Retrospective podcast represents the opinions of that individual. Any similarities to any and all things associated with the films in question are strictly coincidental.
But you've come back to us.
This podcast is for entertainment purposes, and all clips, music, and audio cues are used as such.
It'll make us just like them.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is a Percolated Media production. All rights reserved, and no copyright infringement is intended.
There ain't nothing out there, Mordecai, except a lot of corn.
Stupid old corn.
See you around.
And by the way, since I took notes, I watched this again right after my viewing of Beetlejuice. Just so I could get reacquainted. All right, boys.
That's a palate cleanser.
Put me right back in a bad mood.
Yeah, like a colonoscopy.
Which is the nightmares and whatnot.
Yeah, because it's padding out a movie that's already padded. It's 85 minutes.
Did you like The Sopranos when the fish was talking to Tony?
I don't remember that.
Oh, you don't remember that? When he killed Big Pussy, it's like they had the voice of Big Pussy when he goes into the fish market. The fish started talking to him.
Spoiler alert.
Hey, you're not going to watch it anyway. I'm not worried about you.
Yeah, I'm sorry for spoiling, except that it's 20 years old.
Yeah. Donald visits. We have a lot of interesting names in next week's movie. Matt, what are you expecting when we discuss Children of the Corn 5? I forget the subtitle.
You lost me at Children of the Corn 5.
Fields of Terror. When we discuss Children of the Corn 5, Fields of Terror.